This is Sean with Voices of Racing. I'm speaking with Bob Gates. You've been a rider in the race industry for a long time, is that right?
Yes, that's right. Since, probably 1980, 81, 82. So quite a few years.
All right, so what year were you born and where were you born?
I was born in southern Indiana in 1946.
And where'd you kind of, what was the city and what was the high school that you grew up in?
Well, we moved around quite a bit when I was a kid and ended up in the Greenwood area, Greenwood, Indiana area, and went to Center Grove High School and so, then to IUPUI in Indianapolis for a few semesters.
So was journalism on the horizon, or how did you kind of get into that area?
Well, I always enjoyed reading, and even when as a young kid, I thought about being able to write, especially write books, do books, and I never really dwelled into it until later on in life, like I said, about 1980-81.
So what was that beginning situation that kind of got you into the racing world for documenting through journalism?
Well, it was a way for me to be involved in auto racing, a sport that I was very passionate about. And I was in the hospital in traction for my back. And I read quite a bit, of course, laying there, waiting for surgery, waiting for them to take care of my back. And I just thought to myself, I could write as well as some of what I'm reading. So I did compose, if you would, an article there in the hospital. After I got out, I submitted it. It was published, and it just went from there.
What was the magazine you got into?
Open Wheel magazine.
Open Wheel. And so, yeah. So what was like the first gig that they had you work on? What was the first assignment?
Well, the first piece I did was actually about race driver Johnny Boyd, and he competed in Indianapolis in 1955 into the 1960s. Never won at Indy, but was always one of the top drivers. So I did a story about him, a particular incident in his career. And so that was my first piece. And then from there, it grew to the point where I was covering up-and-coming race car drivers and the midget sprint cars, that type of thing. I remember doing pieces on Tony Stewart, for instance, Robbie Stanley, Jeff Gordon, people like that. And I also did quite a bit of Speedway coverage, Indianapolis Motor Speedway coverage. I did the post 500 articles. I did pre-500 articles, those types of things.
So who were some of the guys that you got to sit down with that were, not so much you kind of documenting their road, but you actually sitting down and getting in their head and really understanding, their process and what essentially, their goals were, whatnot. Who were some of the drivers or major teams you got to sit down with?
Yeah, well, I mentioned Jeff Gordon, of course, and Tony Stewart already. Right. Rick Mears. I did a cover story for Open Wheel magazine with Rick Mears. Al Unser Jr. I did a cover story for Al Unser Jr. Same with his dad, Al Sr. Johnny Rutherford. Oh, gosh, it just really has to stretch. There were very few that I didn't do some work with, I'll put it that way. Parnelli Jones. I did a multiple-issue series on Parnelli Jones.
So was there any situation that you got to interview them right after they were in a bad wreck or they went through something tragic?
Well, I think Rick Mears, I talked to him soon after he had his wreck that damaged his feet and legs very well. He made a comeback, of course. And then Buddy Lazier, I did a piece on Buddy Lazier cover piece after he won the 500 in 1996, and he had broken his back in Phoenix. And so what he accomplished in winning the 500 with a broken back was really a story that a lot of people are not quite aware of.
Wow. So, you know, when somebody goes through that tragedy, and that's a great example, is that they got to get back on the horse and they got to keep going, and they actually end up winning. So, like, from their point of view, what do you think really is the what's driving them, for lack of a better term, at that point, to think, I'm not going to wreck again, I got to keep going, and, you know, my luck's going to keep holding out?
Well, when you're coming back from an injury, which has been studied with race car drivers in particular, and probably most sports figures, it's their passion for what they're doing, their love of what they're doing, that motivates them to get back in the car and do it again. And actually, again, studies have been done that shows they heal faster than the normal patient would with similar injuries. I know Poncho Carter, he crashed testing at Phoenix and damaged his legs quite severely, to the point where the doctors told him that, he would never drive again. And Poncho said, "You just fix me, I'll take care of the driving." Well, again, like so many of the others, he came back and started winning races immediately upon coming back.
Wow. All right. So as you've been able to work with these guys, what were some of the more epic moments that you were able to cover that really kind of stand out, that, you know, were just great moments in racing that, you know, or some people might know of, but you were able to kind of hear it from them, or you were able to be there and cover it?
Well, I think with Al Lester Jr., one thing in particular that comes to mind, I'm not sure if it exactly covers what you're asking, but I remember interviewing him in his motorhome. And I had interviewed and predicted the year before the previous winner of the 500. And I mentioned that to Al. And so during the interview, he reached over and rubbed my shoes for good luck. And he went ahead and won the 500 that year. I don't know that rubbing my shoes did the trick, but it kind of gives you an idea of the guy's, you know, guy's mindset. They so much want to win, especially a place like Indianapolis.
So when you're interviewing them, what are some of the key things that you're asking them? Like, what are you really trying to get in their head and to get them to explain to the public?
Just primarily what makes them race, what makes them want to race, what are they thinking about? One question I like to ask Indy 500 drivers is what their thoughts are as they're sitting there their first year at Indianapolis, never have competed in a race on a track that large with that much going on around them, what their thoughts are just before that gentleman starts your engines. I asked Lee Koonsman that, and his response, he said, "Well, I was praying." And I said, "Praying?" And he said, "Yes." He said, I said, "Dear God, don't let me do something stupid on the first lap and wipe out half the field. And if I do, let me die in the accident so I don't have to face them." So that was his response. And it says something about, they're not afraid of injury. They're not afraid of anything but really failure. And to most of them, anything but first place is failure on their part. It's all about winning. I think Alexander Rossi said in the last year or two, I think he finished second in a recent 500, and he said, "Around here, second place means nothing. It's all about winning." And that's the attitude of most, well, really, of every driver that I've ever talked to. It's about winning. And once you win, whether it's a sprint car race, the Indianapolis 500, that's okay. Now you're ready to win another. Rich Vogler said, told me that what happened last week isn't important. What's important is what's happening tonight. Speaking about a race he was getting ready to compete in.
Right.
So that's.
How many total articles or total pieces do you think you've written? What's a guess?
Oh, gosh, hundreds.
Hundreds.
Yes. Yeah, I wouldn't have an exact count. For years, I've had a monthly article in Speed Sport. I mean, that's been the last probably 5, 6 years that I've done something monthly. In addition, a column monthly, that's in addition to other articles I've done for Speed Sport for other publications.
All right, so one of part of our purpose with Voices of Racing is to not just get the stories of them on the course or kind of leading up, but also be able to kind of get the backstories of their life and what happened before and what's what their life's been like since racing and everything. And you were able to write at least one book. How many books did you write on racers?
Well, I've actually been a part of five books. One on Troy Ruttman, Bill Vukovich, Jim Herdebees, and then I worked with Wilbur Shaw's son to rewrite Wilbur Shaw's great book, Gentlemen Start Your Engines. So we did a rewrite of that just recently, and there was another book that I contributed to. It was about what's known as the Silver Crown Series, which is the USAC National Championship, and what used to be actually the known as IndyCars. But that book was the Dirt Road to the Silver Crown, and so I've been a part of five different books.
Okay, so for Troy Ruttman, we've been basically helping Toddie kind of get the backstory from different people that have worked with him. You're able to write his book. So what was that? Were you able to was he still alive when you were writing his book? That's the first question.
No, he was not.
Okay. So that being said, how many different sources did you have to really work with to be able to get all the different points of view?
Oh, at least 15, 20, including, of course, some very close members of Troy's family, both his daughters, his grandson, his first wife, and some other members, distant members of the family, cousins, nephews, that type of thing, as well as people that he drove for, car owners, that type of thing as well.
So, what's some of the major things about his career? Obviously, he won the 500 when he was the youngest, and at that point still is, in 52. But what are some other aspects of his career that really stood out to you?
Well, his natural ability from a very young age, he was probably one of America's most naturally talented race car drivers. And when I say that, not even every Indy 500 winner or successful race car drivers are born with a natural talent. Parnelli Jones, for instance, admits that about himself, even though some others might differ. Gary Bettenhausen was not a very good race car driver when he started, but he learned to become a good race car driver. And Troy just seemed to take to it immediately when he started racing at 15, 16 years old, to the point that others, his peers, really admired him and looked up to him. He was a hero to Parnelli Jones, for instance, even though they were practically the same age. The same goes for Dan Gurney. So there's a couple of icons in American auto racing that realized early on that Troy Ruttman had something special going on about him, and they looked to him not only as a hero then, but as a mentor as they got involved in their own racing. I think what his peers had to say about him is as important as anything. A.J. Foyt called him the most talented race car driver, sprint car driver that he'd ever seen. And so I think to earn the respect of your peers like that says so much about a driver's talent.
Was it any tragic moment that he just, that he barely got through, or that he that happened and he had to work through?
Well, he had an injury after, within weeks after winning the 1952 500, and that he broke his arm in a very odd sprint car crash, and that actually kept him out of racing for over a year. He missed the 1953 Indianapolis 500 because of complications from that injury. He got terribly overweight. He fell into alcohol. You know, he fought, Dale had to deal with alcoholism his entire life. But in that period especially, it affected him. It affected his marriage. You know, he lost his money. Troy's one of those guys that probably made and lost several fortunes in his lifetime. So him coming back and then to running then the 1954 500 after everything that he went through is quite a story in itself. Excuse me here for a moment.
No, you're fine.
I have a tickling in my throat. So it took a lot for him to come back from that accident, not only physically, but mentally and emotionally. He lost a lot of weight and, you know, got himself into shape throughout the rest of his career. Really, the rest of his life, he was slim and trim. So it took a lot, you know, to make that comeback like that. Probably people of lesser ability, lesser desire to continue doing what he was good at, it would have been almost impossible for them to do.
So what was that transition up to Enzo Ferrari and Formula One?
Well, that came in about 1957. There was a race called the Race of Two Worlds, and that was in Monza, Italy, and it put the American race car drivers and race cars, pitted them against the Europeans, some of the top names in Europe. So Troy competed in that race. It was ran in three heats because of the difficulty of the race itself and the bad shape that the track was in. The cars would break up so quickly that they had to divide the what was going to be a 500-mile race up into three heats. Troy won one of those heats. He had raced some sports cars in Sebring and different places in America prior to that. And so some of the European car owners and other drivers, European drivers, were aware of his talent and were impressed with his ability. And so he was able to run that summer several Formula One races. Now, he did this with some independent teams and did fairly well considering the teams that he was running with, the equipment they had. They weren't necessarily top budget teams. Not factory teams at that point, but there was definitely some interest in him running with Ferrari, or some of the other top Formula One teams at that time. And it's something he passed on. He decided he wanted to spend most of his, do most of his racing here in the States rather than in Europe. Travel was much, much more difficult then. It was much more difficult for an American driver to compete, you know, in Europe. And Phil Hill did that a few years afterwards and won the 1961 World Championship as an American, but it was very difficult for him. It ended up damaging his health. So anyway, again, that says a lot about Troy's talent.
What, was there anything, and I'm not sure if Toddy had mentioned this or somebody else had mentioned this, that he was asked to basically, you know, maybe originally when he was possibly asked to be on a team with them, that he was told that he couldn't pass them?
Well, that was part of racing in Europe at that time as well. And that extended well into the 1960s. You know, if he'd have joined a factory, if he'd been part of the Ferrari team, for instance, there were already drivers in the Ferrari team that he would have to take second place to. And if it came down to, you know, going for the world championship and the teammate was leading the world championship, he would have to back off in order to give his teammate the better opportunity to win the most points towards the championship. That's one reason that A.J. Foyt did not go to Europe. He didn't want to race in Formula One. He did not want to be a part of that type of racing. Colin Chapman asked Parnelli Jones to be part of the Lotus Formula One team, and Parnelli turned him down again for several reasons, but primarily he would have to play second fiddle, if you would, to Jim Clark. And you know, most drivers, most American drivers anyway, that's just not the way they were raised.
You just want to win, right?
You just want to win. Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, most, even in American IndyCar racing today, there's most, a lot of the big teams had several cars, about Penske, Ganassi, Andretti. And there's really no team orders with those guys, because they know it wouldn't do any good. You know, Roger Penske says, just don't take your teammate out.
Right.
Other than that, you can race. And that's just the American attitude, I guess, towards racing. It makes it very difficult for some people to be a part of that.
And don't you think that's a testament to the European style of, you know, we're a little better than, and we're not going to let you showcase your real talent, that's it. I mean,
right.
It's almost like a high school, grade school playground mentality of, you know, I don't know.
Well, and I think it says something about, in European racing and Formula One, just in general, the team is more important than the driver. You know, Enzo Ferrari was renowned for hiring young, brave drivers that didn't necessarily last very long because they were so brave they'd get themselves killed. And I'm not saying that he planned on them getting themselves killed, but they were dispensable in the grand scheme of things. You know, if being aggressive and going after the win aggressively meant that you had an accident, so be it. The constructors' championship was more important than the drivers' championship. In Europe, again, today, whether it's Mercedes, McLaren, or whatever team it is, the constructor or the team's championship is really more important than the driver's championship. And it's just the opposite here in the States. You know, when you're going for a championship, it's the driver championship that's most important, not the teams. And like in Europe, and again, most people don't realize this, but there are two separate championships, really, in all divisions of racing in the United States. There is a team championship, if you would, and a driver's championship. But what gets the most airplay, what's most important, is the individual, the driver championship. And again, that's just that American perspective.
And that's over here, is that the driver's getting more exposure than the team. All right, so out of all the years that you've, how many years, how recently, or do you still write, or when did you retire, or?
No, I'm still writing.
So for example, let's talk about this past Indy 500 and the fact that an individual had won it three times and he was the, you know, came in and won it again, Helio Castroneves. So for that to happen, for that to, you know, the chances of that happening, even the odds with, you know, the playbook and everything, as far as people betting, it was pretty amazing. So just kind of talk to me about what your thoughts were when you saw Helio be able to pull that off, and those last few laps when he was, you know, obviously behind the rookie, and the rookie had the better car, and he was able to, you know, maneuver and get through it. If you could just kind of talk to that for a second.
Absolutely. Helio's experience paid off in this year's race. It's one race, you know, that personally, and I know other people feel this way, that he really went out and took that race. He went out and won that race. He didn't luck into it because somebody broke. It wasn't a fuel mileage race where people ran out of fuel and he didn't. He went out and raced using his experience and his talent and ability for that win. So that's very impressive when a driver can do that. And I know a lot of people thinking about Helio Castroneves as a four-time Indianapolis 500 winner wasn't sure that they could put him in the same category as Rick Mears, Al Unser, or A.J. Foyt.
Right.
Just because racing has changed, and there's a lot of reasons for that, but many people felt that way. And but I think most people, after the way he performed this year, don't begrudge him that at all. But again, they feel as if he, and I've heard this from many people, that they feel he went out and took the race, and the best man won that day. And that's what really racing is all about.
Was it exciting for you, just because he's been in the industry for so long and you've been in the industry for so long, to see him, you know, beat the underdog as far as the rookie that was coming in? Like, what was kind of going through your mind in those last couple laps?
Among my other responsibilities as a writer, I'm also the editor of a quarterly newspaper for the Indianapolis 500 Old Timers. And so when we did the piece about Helio winning the 500 this year, the headline that I used is "Helio went small to win big." And what's interesting is that by winning his fourth 500, and again, I think this is what impressed many people, he didn't go with one of the top budget teams,
Right.
you know, like Penske or Ganassi or Andretti. He went with a small team that's really just beginning to make its way into IndyCar racing just in the last couple of years. So again, I think that showcased his ability, his desire, and his talent. So that was very impressive that he did this with a small team.
Well, a friend of mine was his crew chief. His name's Kevin O'Donnell, and I've known Kevin for a few years. But, you know, when I found out that he was his crew chief, and for this whole season, and then all of a sudden they won, I was, you know, I had a personal, I don't know, I guess a little positive spot in my heart, because, you know, a friend of mine was able to, who I never thought would actually be in the winner's circle with
Right.
one of the top guys, that he was in the industry for a long time, because he also took some time off, but we were very excited for him. So, You know,
Sure.
if you were gonna sum up what has driven you this whole time, and I understand that it's a very exciting sport and everything else, but for you to really document so many things that you've done, what's been the driving force that's really motivated you, and what's been one of your favorite conversations, just in general with somebody in the race industry?
Again, a passion for the sport and a way to be involved in the sport. I think most of us as riders, or maybe yourself, anybody that's involved in racing, probably at one time, maybe as a kid, thought they would love to be a race car driver. And when that doesn't happen for whatever reasons, then we look for ways to stay involved in the sport. And so I think that's and one driver for me is the sport. I love the sport. It's hard to explain why, but my way to stay in the sport is to chronicle it, to write about it. And I think what really motivates me as well is it's a curiosity about the individuals. You know, what makes them do this? What makes them come back after being severely injured? What is it about these guys and gals that make them want to risk their lives in such a sports? Now, what's the motivation behind that? So it's a curiosity, I think, about human nature that keeps me involved in racing and got me involved and keeps me involved in racing at this level with what I'm doing. Gosh, to single out one particular conversation, it's very difficult. I mean, it's been a lot of special times that I've had. I mentioned some with Alistair Jr., for instance, Lee Koontzman. Not all the people I've been involved with are necessarily household names. But you know, their motivation, their desire, and all is just the same. But to be able to sit down and talk to some of my heroes, I'm still a fan at heart, but be able to sit down, for instance, and have breakfast with Parnelli Jones at the Speedway Motel, and be in conversation with him, and have Tony George come up and excuse himself, but needed to talk to Parnelli privately. This was the start of the Indy Racing League, and I know that's what Tony wanted to talk to Parnelli about. That sticks in my mind. But just being a part of the sport and being able to get to know firsthand, consider many of them as friends, that's all been very, very special to me.
That's great. Well, part of our purpose is to be able to, really capture the voices of the old timers and the guys that were involved with each of the different groups, and kind of get the collective knowledge from everybody's point of view. And that's something I'm really looking forward to, especially with the facility we have downtown. We're now partnered with. It's called Silo. It's
Oh, okay.
basically, yeah, it's an auto club, where they store privately owned rides of all, styles and makes, and old and new and exotics. And it's an event space, but we're going to start essentially interviewing race legends on their racing history, and also on their life and people that they've been able to work with. So that's going to be a cool location to be able to do it. But, also us being able to just kind of do it over the phone with different people that are there's
Sure.
you know that have been in the industry for a long time, but they like to kind of showcase their life to be able to pass it on for their families and their immediate fans and whatnot. But I think you're a very prominent resource that I'd like to keep in contact with, just because
Sure.
you've really been able to get in the heads of the whole industry. So your brain and wealth of knowledge from everybody's point of view is a pretty pretty much a great melting pot. And I don't know if you've ever really kind of thought about it like that, but you, to get the perspectives of everybody and, you know, what it'll speak to so many different things is very valuable for people that want to know about the industry. So, I commend you for everything you've done to be able to document it.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate that. Never really gave it that thought, to be quite honest. Just something, again, that I'm passionate about. I enjoy, I love. And, you know, it's just, if you can imagine being a football fan and being able to go into the Colts locker room and talk to these guys, you know, by their first name, know them that well, that's kind of where I'm at in racing. And so that's very special.
That's beautiful. All right, well, Bob, I'm going to have you just stay on the line for a second, but this is obviously can be found at voicesofracing.com, and I really appreciate your time today.
No problem.
All right.